طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, a discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it every week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. We begin this week featuring two Palestinian voices, that of Mohammed El-Kurd and Ahmad Al-Nauk, critiquing the Western media's coverage of Palestine-Israel. Our recording of this conversation is taken from a recent Mondo Weiss podcast and includes introductions and context for the discussion.
This is the Mondo Weiss podcast. I'm Dave Reed. In this episode, Mondo Weiss's culture editor, Mohammed El-Kurd, speaks with journalist and co-founder of We Are Not Numbers, Ahmad Al-Nauk. Despite having 21 members of his family murdered by Israel in the past few months, Al-Nauk has been on the forefront of advocating for Palestinian liberation. In this conversation, they talk about the complicity of mainstream media in the genocide Israel is committing against Palestinians in Gaza.
Welcome, Ahmad. It is such an honor to be with you today. I appreciate your time. Despite everything that's going on, I understand how much energy this takes. I want to begin by asking you to introduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you, Ahmad. It's actually my honor to speak to you. I've been following you for a long, long time. And as I told you before, you're an icon for Palestine. I'm very proud of you. All of Palestine is proud of you. So thank you very much. Introducing myself, I'm just an average Palestinian person, not special. Okay, my name is Ahmad Al-Nauk, and I'm 29 years old. I have lived all my life in Gaza until I was 25 years old, when I traveled to the UK to do my master's degree in international journalism. Before that, I did my BA in English literature at Al-Azhar University. When I was in Gaza, I co-founded a project called We Are Not Numbers with an American journalist. Her name is Pam Bailey. Together, we started a project called We Are Not Numbers. And then I also co-founded another project called Across the Wall. I also worked at a human rights organization called the Euromedia Human Rights Organization. And now I'm a journalist in London.
You say you're an average person, but it's not average to co-found multiple organizations, multiple projects. And it's not average to take on the role of a media ministry.
You could say that I was a little bit lucky, luckier than most of the Palestinians in Gaza. The trajectory of my life before the war in 2014 was different from now. So I was a very average Palestinian person. I just happened to speak English at that time. At that time, during that war, I lost my brother. And then my friend, the journalist, asked me to write about my brother. And writing the story about my brother at that time, it changed all of my life. And I was lucky to have a friend who speaks English, who's an American, who gave me the platform to write about my brother. But many, many other Palestinians were way more special than me, but they did not have this opportunity. So they did not have this turn of event in their life.
It's amazing how English is a bit of a currency, or English can become a bit of a currency. And it can change the trajectory of people's lives. I mean, I grew up in a very similar situation where my ability to speak English, albeit broken English, transformed the chances of me being heard. Because we know that many journalists, particularly foreign journalists, who come to the Gaza Strip or who come to Jerusalem, toy with our stories. They don't do their due diligence. They don't report accurately. And so, as I said earlier, you are transformed into a one-person media ministry where you're supposed to not only withstand or heft a crime and an atrocity committed against you by the Israeli regime, but you are then tasked with the task of reporting on it and advocating for yourself and your family and neighbors. In the past few weeks, we have seen you, because of the genocide unfolding in Gaza, we have seen you take the center stage, and we have seen you talk about not only the many members of your families who have been martyred and have been murdered by Zionist forces, but talk about the situation unfolding in the Gaza Strip. And such work is not without challenges. You have been met with a lot of hostility from mainstream media. Can you talk to us a little bit about this?
So, yeah, I have met with a lot of hostilities from the mainstream media here and from people who follow the mainstream media. But I also have to say that I have also met with a lot of love and sympathy and support from the British public. And this tells you how different the people and the public from the institutions in the UK, from the government, from the mainstream media. But yeah, my experience with the mainstream media in the UK was a little bit difficult, to be honest. And you have mentioned before that now in Gaza, I was speaking to the media and I have talked about my family and about the people in Gaza. At that time, when Israel killed my family, I feel that I really need the time to grieve my family and stay in my home. Don't go to work. Don't speak to anyone, because I've lost 21 members of my family. And these members of my family, Mohammed, you are from Palestine as well. And you know how in Palestine, we are socially connected to each other. Our family is the most important thing in your life. My father was the most loved person. I loved him more than everyone in the world. My brothers, my sisters, my nieces and nephews and everyone. And at the moment you lose all of them, you would feel that you want a lot of time to grieve, not a few days. You need a lot of time to grieve. But we Palestinians, because we have been failed by the Western media for a long time, for 75 years, we feel that now we have a responsibility towards our people. We can't just grieve and ignore the suffering of the other Palestinians. We can't ignore our responsibility to talk to the people here. So I was not reluctant a moment to go and speak about my family and about my people. But first, this brings me to another important issue here. I was interviewed by most of the mainstream media, like all of them in the UK. And the reason they interviewed me, not because they care a lot about the Palestinians, but because I forced them to interview me in a way or another, because I posted about my family. I posted about what happened to them. I talked about my father, my brother, my sisters, my nieces and nephews. I talked about them on my Twitter, my personal account on Twitter, and people shared my posts widely. And hundreds of thousands of people read my post. Millions of people read my post and shared them and posted about them. And there was a huge sympathy within the British public, actually, about my people. And then the Western media was forced to talk about my story, because here is a person who can speak English and who lives in London. And the media has, the social media has been publishing a lot about him. So they were forced to interview me. And they did not interview me because they care about me, or because they love me, or they care about the Palestinian voices. They feel that they can't ignore this story because it's big. And the alternative media outlets also interviewed me, like Double Down News and Novara Media and other alternative media in the UK, they interviewed me. So they were forced to interview me. And then my experience with them was a little bit weird. For example, one of the, Mohammed, you have been on the media hundreds of times. Before they ask you to go to the studio, they would do like a pre-interview and they would ask you. I guarantee you, many, many of them would ask me, Ahmad, are you prepared to condemn Hamas when you are live? And I would tell them, why do you even need to ask me this question? You're interviewing a person who lost all of his family. So why do you even want to ask me this question? Do you think this is a sensitive question? So the question of condemning Hamas was always there. Another interview, they asked me, do you consider Hamas a terror organization? I was shocked, because they interview you not because they want to hear you. They interview you because they want to embarrass you. They want the Palestinians who live in the UK to attack Hamas and to condemn Hamas and to consider Hamas a terrorist organization. But why do they want to ask us these questions? They want to give the audience a gesture or an implication that these Palestinians, they hate Hamas. They think Hamas a terrorist organization. They condemn Hamas. So Israel has the right and the duty to kill Hamas and to destroy Gaza. And then they would give a justification to Israel to do whatever they want with the Palestinian people. On ITV, that was a few days after I lost my family, they interviewed me and they guaranteed me. They said that they have psychologists and they will support me. They will be sensitive to me. And they gave me many assurances. And then when I was live with them, they asked me, Ahmed, do you think, were your family close to you? I mean, yes, were your family close to you?
Were they remarkable?
Yes.
It's absolutely remarkable. It's as though they do not see us as human beings. And in fact, they ask us these questions on whether we condemn Hamas to see whether you are condemnable, whether they can condemn you or not. It's about, you know, dividing those who are with them or who they see as humans and those who they don't see as humans. And it's absolutely...
It is a litmus test. It's a test.
Yeah, so it's absolutely...
If you condemn Hamas, then you have the agency. You can have a voice. If you don't condemn Hamas, then we shouldn't talk to you. Then you're a terrorist or a terrorist sympathizer. They want to test your humanity before you go with them, as if Hamas is a test. If you condemn
you don't
Hamas,
have the option. You don't. And I think one piece of information that falls between the cracks is that if we are located in Britain or if we're located in the United States, condemning Hamas is not an option because there are laws in place that says we are only allowed to have one opinion. Otherwise, we risk legal persecution. So it's not only this is not only a racist line of questioning that has only one answer, but it's also an endangerment of the guests. But my next question to you is, do you condemn Hamas? No, I'm kidding.
It's a trap, Muhammad. It's a trap.
It's not.
Because there isn't yes or no answer to it. Whether you answer yes or no, you're in a problem. And we are against the premise of this question.
Absolutely.
I don't want to ask this question in the first place. And that's why every time I'm asked this question, I don't want to answer it. I don't want to answer it, not because I'm afraid of this question, but I refuse the premise of this question.
It has nothing to do with...
We ask this question.
It has nothing to do with the... It's just a complete racist double standard that has nothing to do with the interview. You said something about mainstream media versus alternative media. And I was wondering, you know, with mainstream media, my feeling is the reason you were invited is because, like you said, the crime perpetrated against your family was so significant that they could not ignore it. And I am afraid that if it weren't for these massive prices you were forced to pay and your family was forced to pay, then you would not have been invited. Do you feel like the questions were a bit different when they came from alternative media networks?
They're very different. This is a very important issue, Muhammad, is that the mainstream media or the Western media only give the Palestinians a voice when there is a bloodshed, when we lose loved ones. For example, the first time when I lost my brother in 2014, I had a chance to write about my brother. And this time it took me to lose 21 family members and my home to be interviewed by the Western media, to be allowed to give my voice. And this is very dangerous. The Palestinian people have been going through slow death for 75 years. But slow death for the Western media doesn't matter. It's okay. We can die. We can live under occupation. We can live under siege. We can live under collective punishment. We can live under checkpoints and settlements and all of that. And we would never be asked to give our testimony, to speak to the media. It only takes them to lose not only one member of my family, multiple members. All of my family had to die in Gaza in order to be interviewed with one or two or five mainstream media outlets. And not all of them were actually respectful. Some of the questions were actually rude to me. One of them, for example, I'm going to give you an example. And this interview, I did not post on my social media. It was with Talk TV. And I told the host that I lost 21 family members. And they said, collateral damage. It's okay. And I told them, you're talking about human lives here. Do you believe in the international law? He said, no. What about the UN? The UN is a spin force, he said. What about the human rights? They don't care. And then he said, why don't you revolt against Hamas? I told him, well, if the Palestinians in Gaza did not revolt against Hamas or stood up against Hamas, does that give Israel the right to bomb Gaza indiscriminately, kill all of these people? And he said, yes. So some of these interviewers were very, very rude to me and they're so insensitive. And they can speak in the UK and they can talk all of this genocidal language and no one cares about them. But if a Palestinian ever said this about Israel, they will definitely be charged with terrorism or hate speech.
Or yeah. It's our duty to reject the premise of the question because what we are being told time and time again is that the Palestinian need to live up to a certain set of characteristics and only then will we condemn their killing or only then will we deem them mournable. I see this also with the, you know, with the Israeli propaganda tactic of like saying that they found Hitler's Mein Kampf in people's homes. And I'm of the opinion, I know it's propaganda, I know it's fake news, but I'm of the opinion if every single house in Gaza had a copy of Mein Kampf, that does not excuse genocide. We cannot transform thoughts and ideas and even simple ignorance into cause for killing and murder. That's not how the world works. And this cannot apply to any other people in the world today, except for Palestinians, that the contents of your heart or the perceived contents of your hearts render you killable. That is, to me,
exactly.
Insane.
It is insane. It is insane. And we have seen multiple reports in Gaza. For example, in Jabalia, in the few first days of the war, they bombed a neighborhood in Jabalia, killing 400 people because they said there was a Hamas commander there. So for them, the lives of 400 people doesn't matter. They don't care about the 400 people, and they bombed the area, and eventually there was no Hamas. I don't understand what is the use of law, international law, and the system, if you are going to kill everyone for just the... Go to Gaza if you find someone who you can charge, who deserved it. Okay, we can talk about it, but because you have a book, then you can kill the man, you can kill his children, you can kill, destroy his home, you can destroy the economy of Gaza. It's unbelievable. And I'm just shocked that the Western media takes these reports and talk about them as if they're like justifiable.
Absolutely.
People are anti-Semitic and whatever. So,
I mean, it's not shocking that the Israelis are using these kinds of laws and propaganda. It's what they're supposed to do, right? We are at war. They're supposed to play dirty. This is how they have historically operated. What I am extremely angered with is the fact that, like you said, media and journalists, self-respecting journalists with awards and years of education can take these and start, you know, legitimizing them and parroting them and repeating them and echoing them. Yani, recently, today, there was a report from Rolling Stone and a report from Washington Post saying that they have found that there is no evidence whatsoever that Hamas has been operating under a Shifa hospital. This is something we've known, but the fact that they have entertained this idea, this allegation for many, many weeks, and the fact that they even took it into consideration and participated, I would argue, in the slaughter of hundreds of Palestinians, of babies in incubators, of real people every single day, is absolutely bizarre to me, because I'm, again, of the mind that even if there was a Hamas base, let's say there was a Hamas operative under the hospital, that gives nobody the right to bomb a hospital. That gives nobody the right to kill 1,000 people in the name of killing one so-called terrorist. During the Palestinian Literature Festival event in London last week, I had the absolute pleasure of hearing you speak, and it was rather an impassioned remark, and it wasn't written down, but it was clear that it was overflowing from the heart. And the one thing you left us all with one note, which you said that the media was also complicit in the killing of your family. It's not that they are biased. It's not that they're discriminating against Palestinians or that they're racist. It's not that there's just a double standard for Palestinians, but they are participating actively in the genocide of Palestinians. I'm wondering if you can expand on this a little bit for me and for the audience, and to tell us how you imagine a path forward. What do you demand of the media?
Well, I've said it before that the Western media killed my family. They're not only complicit, they actually killed my family, because it doesn't take only pulling the trigger in order to kill someone. It takes incitement, it takes a smear, it takes propaganda, it takes lies, it takes providing a cover and atmosphere for Israel to do whatever they desire. And Israel could never do that without the support of the Western media, without the coverage of the Western media that provided Israel with whatever they need in order to do atrocities against the Palestinian people. And this did not start only on the 7th of October, the media. It had started long time ago. Since the creation of Israel, the Western media has been complicit against the Palestinian people. They have portrayed the Palestinians as savages, as terrorists who live under the rubble, who want to kill their Jews. And they always mention the word Jews. I don't know why. I don't know why the media always say that the Palestinians want to kill the Jews. I actually understand why. They want to create this impression in the Western audience that this is a war against the Jewish people, against the Jews. And no matter how many, many Jewish people in the UK and America protested against Israel and they protested Zionism, they always insist that the Palestinians hate the Jews. It makes us look like we are vicious, that we are vile, that we hate the Jews because they are Jews, and that they are trying to protect the Jewish people from these Palestinian people. So the Western media has always played this part in portraying the Palestinians as terrorists, as we are savages, that we are the Muslims, the Arabs, the people who hate the West, who we hate civilization, and that we live, for example, and this is not only for them. This is not also the drama. The Hollywood in America, they always portray the Arabs and the Muslims as people who live in tents, in camels, and they're not civilized like the Westerners. And the Israelis are white, and they are Europeans, and they are like them. So they always made this distinction between us and the Israelis, as we are Muslims, they are non-Muslims, they are Jewish. We are brown or Arabs, and they are white Europeans. They are civilized. We're savages for the past 75 years. And then I have noticed this media coverage and how biased it was when I was in Gaza, when I lost first my brother. And then I was only 19 years old. And then I was in Gaza. I've seen the horrors of the war. I've seen the horrors of the blockade of Gaza. Firsthand, I've seen all of that in front of my eyes. And then I would go to the Western media, read the stories there, and to always portray us as savages, as these Muslims. And for them, Islamist or Muslim is a bad word. It's not a good word. The Arabs, the Hamas, we are all Hamas. They don't care. And they always would justify for Israel the killing of the Palestinians. And they would always prevent, they would always do not give the Palestinians the agency, their narrative, their testimony. They don't interview the Palestinians often. And then we started, We Are Not Numbers, and we started to speak to the media and write in English. But then the other time where I saw this stark distinction and this stark bias of the media, it was during the March of Return. In the March of Return, I wish you were there, Muhammad. It's really remarkable what happened in the March of Return. For 2 years, every week, the Palestinians in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands would go and would protest peacefully. And this was a message from the Palestinian people. They said that we have tried everything in order to get our own rights. Let's try peaceful protesting for a long period of time. And I would go there every week as a journalist, by the way, not as a participant, as a journalist. And I would go there and report and see what happens in the March of Return. And I would see tens of thousands of Palestinians, women, men, children, old men, people from all colors, from all faiths, from all political affiliations would come to the March of Return and protest. And they would not only protest, but would also do weddings in the March of Return, cultural activities, book clubs, vendors you would find selling stuff. It was life there. You could see life of all its colors in the March of Return. And you would see some angry men, of course, protesting Israel, of course, definitely. And then you would see a few Israeli soldiers fortified behind their tanks and hills and military bases. And they would snipe the Palestinians every day, killing 10, 15, 60 Palestinians, for example, in Gaza, injuring hundreds and thousands of Palestinians, maiming hundreds of Palestinians for just being there, for just protesting their right of return. The right of return. And for 2 years, the Palestinians continued to do that and that protest again and again and again. And then you would see, and then you would go and read what the Western media says. You would read what the BBC is talking about. On that 14th of May, Israel killed 59 protesters in Gaza, peaceful protesters. Many of them were killed in front of my eyes. I was there and I saw Israel shooting an 11-year-old boy who was so far away from the fence, and I saw a bullet in his head, and he died immediately. He was just a few meters away from me, doing nothing. He was even had his bag, his school bag, on his back, and he was killed. I saw someone who got a bullet in his eye, and I saw like blood coming out of his eye. Hundreds of people were shot for protesting peacefully. And then you would read the BBC on the 14th of May. They said 59 Palestinians died at Gaza border. They would say Palestinians die. So it's always the Palestinians die. The Israelis are killed. They're massacres. They're a genocide in Israel, whatever. And then you would read the story. They would quote the Israeli army. They wouldn't even quote the Palestinians who protest on the March of Return. They wouldn't come to the Gaza and write features about the Palestinians who were shot with the families who lost their loved ones in the March of Return. They wouldn't quote the organizers of the March of Return. They wouldn't do that. And why do you do that? Why do you say the Palestinians die and the Israelis killed? Why do you even say the Palestinians die? Why can't you write the headline? You're a journalist and you know that headlines should be an active voice. Why can't you say Israel killed 59 Palestinian protesters while they are protesting the right of return? And on that, the New York Post, for example, wrote a story, a feature on the Israelis who live in the kibbutz around Gaza, interviewing them, how they feel about the Palestinians who are protesting, for example. And I was like, why can't you do proper journalism? But I know why, because they don't want the truth to be conveyed. And then I went to the UK and I started doing my master's in journalism. My dissertation was about the March of Return and the coverage of the Western media in the March of Return. And then I was doing a research on how the Western media coverage on Palestine and Israel was. And then I was stumbled by hundreds of books, research, papers. Everyone is saying that the Western media is biased when it comes to Israel and Palestine. And you might think that the BBC did not do this research. Of course, they know about this research. Of course, they know what's going on in Gaza. Of course, they know the criticism that they have. But why do they keep on? Why do they insist on dehumanizing the Palestinians, depriving them of their voice, refusing to give them the agency, their narrative? Why? Because they are complicit in what Israel is doing, because they have interests in this conflict, and they are siding with Israel. They do not serve as a media outlet. They don't serve as journalists.
They benefit from this world order, Yanni. This is in their best interest.
Yes, they're mouthpieces for Israel.
They're both, absolutely. Exactly. This is why, Yanni, this is why, again, you have suffered the innumerable losses and you have witnessed great horrors. And this is why initiatives like We Are Not Numbers is incredibly important. But I cannot help but wonder about, I think this is my reading of the situation, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this. But I think a lot of us Palestinians, a lot of allies of Palestinians, we recognize the failures of these mainstream media institutions. We recognize even their complicity. And yet we still turn to them for facts. We still turn to them for recognition and acknowledgement. And we do not support our own initiatives. We do not support, yani, there are people that read We Are Not Numbers, but it's certainly not as many people, as many Palestinians who read Haaretz or who read the New York Times. And I think if we are able to invest as much energy in our own institutions, uplifting our own people, our spokespeople, we would be in a very different place. I am not at all minimizing the lack of resources. I'm not minimizing the censorship and censure that we have to deal with. I'm not minimizing the racism that we have to deal with. I'm not minimizing also the structural differences whereby they have billions of dollars and we have, you know, a few shekels. But still, there is an issue here of, I think, self-respect, of respecting one's own craft, one's own dignity, one's own people, one's own initiative. And I wonder, how do you feel about this?
I don't know, actually. I think we, the Palestinians, we should invest more in the alternative media. And I believe that. But you know, in Gaza, for example, we have a saying that in Gaza, there is 1 million citizen journalists in Gaza. Everyone in Gaza serves as a citizen journalist. And I believe the Palestinians now have reverted to the social media rather than the Western media or the alternative media. But I think right now we the Palestinians, we're doing a huge success on this field in terms of the social media and in terms of the alternative media. The alternative media is flourishing right now in the West. But I think it's now not the responsibility of the Palestinians to do that, but it's the responsibility for the Western audiences to go to the alternative media and to read the alternative media, whether it was Palestinians or non-Palestinians, because there are many, many other websites now and media outlets that are not mainstream, but they are doing very proper journalism, very good journalism on Palestine. And I believe that it's now the responsibility to dig more and to avoid and to boycott the mainstream media, the Western media, actually, because until now, still the mainstream media is the most viewed. Mm-hmm. Now, if we compare between We Are Not Numbers and the BBC, I mean, the readers of We Are Not Numbers, they are very, very few. Thousands.
In comparison.
Yeah. So I think now it's the Western media, the Western audiences have a responsibility to boycott their own media. Because if they boycott their own media, if they kept writing to the editors of these publications, I think they will make a change. And I'm not actually interested in destroying the Western media, but I want them to be better. I want them to do proper journalism. I want them to be neutral. I don't want them to be pro-Palestine and to be mouthpieces for Palestine. No, I want them to be neutral. I want them to do their job as it should be. And I think the Palestinians are helping a lot. When we in Palestine record, everyone is having, and now they have a smartphone, and they record what's going on in Palestine, and they post on the social media, and then these posts get shared and published widely. We're doing our job as Palestinians. We are doing our job, and now
let me ask you a final question, Yani. After you gave your remarks during the PALFest event, and I say this today, you are incredibly, Yani, I don't want to use words like courageous or brave or anything, but you're incredibly inspirational to be able to remain level-headed despite everything and to be able to offer us all of this insight and incredible analysis. And this kind of expertise only comes from a person that has seen a lot, and not only has seen a lot, but can engage what he has seen critically. Right now in the West, we are seeing unprecedented levels of censorship and punishment and recrimination against Palestinians and pro-Palestinians. But I am very optimistic about all of this. I think it's an exciting transition. I think they are intimidated and threatened by the kind of pro-Palestinian sentiment that is growing. So as we close, I just want to ask, how do you see the next few years? Where do you think we should go and what should we be doing?
This is a very interesting question, Muhammad, because
it's big.
You know, sometimes I would feel so depressed, so optimistic, so pessimistic about what's going on in Palestine. When I look in Gaza and read the news and I see the levels of destruction and horror and fear and starvation in Gaza. Starvation. Can you believe it? There is starvation in Gaza. And the military occupation, and I would see the world powers, they support Israel unequivocally. They still give Israel the weapons and the diplomacy and everything to keep on fighting the Palestinians and oppressing the Palestinians. And all of that is depressing to me. It makes me feel pessimistic. But what makes me very, very optimistic is the power of the Palestinian people. Because the Palestinian people are very, very powerful. They're very proud. They're doing wonders in Palestine, and they are, despite all the struggle and fear and the war and destruction that they endure, they're still emerge as lovely people, beautiful people, as people who are staying in their lands and refuse to leave their lands and homes. And they still love life, and they want to build life, and they want to have a better future. And they're working very, very hard. I've seen the doctors who work in Gaza. They do not sleep for many, many days, despite the lack of equipment, despite the lack of support, despite the lack of supplies. They're still working. I see the journalists. 93 journalists have been killed since the 7th of October in Gaza. But yet, the Palestinian journalists are still working day and night. Now I've seen Wael al-Dahdouh. He's a symbol of resistance, of power. And he lost his wife. He lost his children. And the other day, he went on camera and he continued covering the news. He was injured a few days ago and his colleague was killed. And yet he's still speaking. He's still doing this coverage. So these people, they can make wonders. And as long as we have a people who are so courageous, who are so lovely, who are so powerful, I think the future is ours. And I'm also very hopeful when I see the British people and the American peoples.
You've been listening to Mohammed El-Kurd and Ahmad Al-Nauk discussing the Western media's coverage of Palestine, which was featured on a Mondo Weiss podcast. Before we sign off, I want you to hear Normal Finkelstein's response to Hillary Clinton's reasons for opposing an immediate call for a ceasefire in Gaza. The recording is taken from the Crystal Ball News program.
You mentioned a little while ago that our former Secretary of State and former First Lady Hillary Clinton has been making the rounds laying out her argument for why she is opposed to a ceasefire, even after all of the many civilians who have been killed by Israel in this conflict. She laid out her argument in an Atlantic piece. She said that ceasefires freeze conflicts rather than resolve them. In 2012, freezing the conflict in Gaza was an outcome that we and the Israelis were willing to accept. But Israel's policy since 2009 of containing rather than destroying Hamas has failed. A ceasefire now that restored the pre-October 7th status quo would leave the people of Gaza living in a besieged enclave under the domination of terrorists and leave Israelis vulnerable to continued attacks. It would also consign hundreds of hostages to continued captivity. She also made an appearance on The View where she bolstered this argument with her version of some of the recent history. Let's take a listen to a little bit of what she said there.
The problem predates October 7th, and I think that's what President Obama was talking about, because let's remember, this is a very long and complicated history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My husband, with the Israeli government at the time in 2000, offered a Palestinian state to the Palestinians, at that time run by Arafat, Yasser Arafat.
Right. The PLO.
And the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which, by the way, took out of its charter violence against Israel. Mm-hmm. So you got to separate the Palestinians who believe that there is some future of peace with Hamas, which believes it has to destroy Israel.
Yes.
Those are two different organizations, and they have to be viewed in that way. Arafat turned that down. There would have been a Palestinian state now for 23 years if he had not walked away from it. There was another attempt when I was Secretary of State to try to, you know, bring the Palestinians and the Israelis together. That didn't work out. Hamas came in and basically destroyed all of that and killed a lot of other Palestinians. So I think when President Obama says that, it requires us to look at the history. And, of course, history holds all of us accountable.
So what is your view of
Except Hillary Clinton, who destroyed Libya. History holds all of us accountable except Hillary Clinton. But let's leave that aside. What I would like you to do, Crystal, is simply ask me one specific question from that. She made many, many statements. She talked about 2000, when her husband presided over the attempted peace agreement. She talked about Hamas, how Hamas destroyed everything. She talked about ceasefires don't exist. You would not have time for another question if I were to go into all of that. So you use your, you know, you use your intelligence. You're very smart. Which aspect do you find most challenging? And then I'll try to answer it going through the details.
Well, one of the claims that she made there, which I hear repeated often, is that it was on the Palestinian side that peace has been rejected. And she says there that Palestinians could have had a state now for 23 years had Yasser Arafat not walked away from the deal that her husband was attempting to craft. So do you agree with that assessment? What does she get wrong there?
Well, she gets everything wrong, and I'm going to try to explain why. I do know the details, and I hope the listeners will forgive me for going into the details. There have been four basic issues to try to resolve this conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, okay? Issue is, number one, borders. Where should the borderline be drawn between Israel and the Palestinians? The Palestinians accepted the position of the international community. The border line should be drawn where it was before the June 1967 war. That is, the whole of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, would form an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. The Palestinians accepted the position of the international community, all the legal bodies in the world, the International Court of Justice, all the political bodies, the UN General Assembly, everybody accepted the border should be what's called the pre-June 1967 border or the whole of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and Gaza would be the Palestinian state side by side with Israel. Israel rejected that position. Israel wanted a part of the West Bank. In its last offer, it wanted approximately 8% of the West Bank. So it rejected the international community's position. Number two, under international law, East Jerusalem belonged to the Palestinian state because under international law, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. Israel acquired the East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza in the course of the 1967 war. It had no legal title to East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. Israel rejected that position of the international community. It said it wanted parts of East Jerusalem. Number three, there's the question of the settlements that Israel has built in the occupied Palestinian territories. Approximately now 700,000 settlers, illegal settlers under international law in the West Bank. All of those settlers are illegally in the West Bank. Right now, as we speak, engaging in a low level, at this point, ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. Israel wanted to keep under its sovereignty approximately 80% of those settlers. And finally, there's the question of the Palestinian refugees and their descendants since 1948. Israel said that it would not allow any of those refugees to return under what's called the right of return, the international law, which says refugees have the right to return to their homes after the cessation of hostilities. Israel said no. Now, on all of those questions, borders, Jerusalem, settlements, refugees, on all of those questions, the Palestinians were willing to make concessions. And in the year 2000, President Clinton put forth what were called the parameters, December 2000. Parameters for resolving the conflict. All of those parameters required concessions from the Palestinians on the basis of international law. None of Clinton's parameters required concessions from Israel on the basis of international law. Now, I want the listeners to hear the bottom line. In January 2001, both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side accepted what were called the Clinton parameters with reservations. Both sides said, we accept with reservations. It is factually untrue. President Clinton, who's an extremely smart guy with a voracious intellectual appetite, he's unfortunately also an exceptional liar. And in his memoir, which I read, he simply lied about what happened to his parameters that he put forth in December 2000. And Hillary Clinton, who is apparently quite smart also, as smart as her husband, I'm not sure, but no question, a very smart woman. She is also an inveterate, to the point of pathological, liar. That's not, you know, I'm not trying to be ad hominem. I think there's quite a lot of evidence going back to why she lost the election that she's a pathological liar. She literally can't see the lies that she's uttering. So those are just factual questions where I can say with a great deal of confidence, because I've read the entire diplomatic record, and I'm willing to debate anybody on it, that what she's saying is false. It's doubly false. It's false because the Palestinians accepted the terms for resolving the conflict, which have been developed and ratified by the whole international community. Just to give you one example, every single year, the United Nations General Assembly passes a resolution called Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. And every year, it lays out the terms which I just described. The terms of the settlement are anchored, embedded in international law. Every year, the vote is the whole world, which is to say approximately 190 countries on one side, embracing those terms, including the Palestinian representative organizations. And on the other side, it's usually the United States, Israel, and several South Sea islands, the Marshall Islands, Palau, Tuvalu, Tonga, on the other side. Now, if any of your listeners have doubts, which surely they have the right to, all they have to do is Google Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question, United Nations General Assembly. And that resolution will come right up on the screen. It's a little more complicated to get to the voting record, but with enough conscientiousness and ingenuity, which I lack on the web, I don't know anything about computers, they can easily find the whole world on one side, the U.S., Israel, and some South Sea Island atolls on the other side. That's the real record. And if Hillary Clinton wants to debate me on it, or her husband, I'm perfectly happy to do so.
Well, and I would be perfectly happy to moderate that debate. I think that would be great for the country to see.
That was Normal Finkelstein discussing Hillary Clinton's reason for opposing an immediate ceasefire in Gaza on the Crystal Ball News Show. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.